Hi, I'm Daniel Strauss. I'm a reporter for Talking Points Memo in Washington, D.C., and I'm here with
Betsy
Betsy.
Woodruff of the Washington Examiner. I'm a political writer.
And we're going to give you a campaign edition of Blogging Heads today. Hi, Betsy. By the way, congratulations on the new job. You're a week in, something
Yeah,
like that?
new gig. This is the last day of the first week, so it's been fun. I was previously at National Review.
Yes, and I was a big fan of your stuff there.
Thanks. Likewise.
So we're finishing up this week, and the campaign world is finally heating up, which to my great happiness is, getting interesting because I've been covering campaigns for the past few months since I joined TPM, and it's been a little slower going. The most recent thing that went on was there were a few gaffes or gaffetastic events this week. And the most recent one was Bruce Braley, who had been seen as the inevitable successor to Tom Harkin in Iowa, was taped in a fund at a fundraiser for lawyers, warning that if Republicans could take control of the Senate, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee would be a mere farmer, which is a
Womp
direct reference. Which is a direct reference to Chuck Grassley, who actually went to grad school for, I don't think he finished his degree, but he doesn't have a law degree, and he's a ranking member on the Senate Judiciary Committee. It got a little worse in the next 2 days or so when Braley's staff tried to do damage control and sent out a press release highlighting his background with farming and misspelled two farming terms. Detasseling and baling. And then BuzzFeed also caught on a Braley's Facebook a picture of a farm that was supposedly or seemed to imply that it was in Iowa, but it was actually in Europe. So,
Yeah,
yeah.
I'm happy I'm not Bruce Braley right now. I imagine this hasn't been the best week of his entire life.
Yeah, so about this, I mean, I've seen a few of, in a few days earlier, there was some hubbub about a new ad from Mitch McConnell's reelection campaign that featured a Duke basketball player instead of a player from a Kentucky basketball team. And this came during March Madness. It doesn't seem as big of a gaffe, and frankly, as Emily Schulteis wrote in Morning Score this morning. I don't think either of these things are going to bring down the campaigns, but they're definitely, they definitely give ammo to the opposition.
Right.
How much do you think, Betsy, this is to blame on staffers, and how much do you think goes to the candidate?
Well, I think in the case of the McConnell ad, that seems like it's clearly a staff thing. I don't think Senator McConnell is sitting on YouTube trying to pull clips of basketball players. And that definitely seems like either staff or the company that they hired to put the ad together. The thing with these gaffes is that, obviously they don't really reflect on the ability of these candidates to govern. What they seem to reflect more so is just I don't know, some maybe laziness or lack of judiciousness or some competence issues. And I think these become liabilities only when they make the candidate seem silly or unserious. Everybody loved the Braley gaffe because it was really funny. It's just a silly thing to say. It's funny to hear a guy, hating on farmers who's trying to represent, a state that's driven by agribusiness. That's amusing. It's amusing when McConnell has a campaign ad featuring a Duke basketball player. Does that reflect on McConnell's ability to lead his party in the Senate? Probably not. Is it still really funny? Definitely. Like, I'm gonna click that stuff. Zero question.
I mean, yeah, these in particular are really, really juicy sort of gaffe moments, yeah. right? I mean, Duke is one of those teams that most people who follow college basketball really hate. And, you know, it is, you know, the knock on Democrats is that they're elitist. And so you have this Democrat, this well-educated Democrat saying, you know, pa, he's just a farmer. It is, you know, it's funny. I want to know if you thought this. I feel like the entire campaign world this cycle is waiting on a sort of Todd Akin moment. And, like, immediately after the Bruce Braley gaffe came out, the NRSC started saying, you know, he was Todd Akin-like. Nick Confessori at the New York Times said that this seemed like his 47% comment. Both of those assessments seem to be a little bit of a stretch to me. I'm wondering why there's this hunger for that one thing, that one like comment that people could sort of blow up and talk about for days and would ostensibly bring down a campaign like Akin's.
Well, I think one of the great things about these gaffes is that they're very user friendly. I mean, the 47% remark, the Akin remark, Akin's name has now become synonymous with, you know, running and having an incompetent, unelectable candidate. You know, pulling an Akin is now a thing. And talking about candidates in terms of these really problematic sound bites is a lot easier than, say, going into their positions on Medicare or parsing previous votes on, you know, as our foreign policy and stuff. It's very simple. It's very easy to explain. Often they're entertaining. It makes for great footage for campaign ads. It's just a very, very user-friendly, very accessible way to take a hit at a candidate who otherwise might be significantly less vulnerable. I think one thing that's interesting about the Braley gaffe is that it was caught by the America Rising PAC, which is a conservative organization that's focusing really aggressively on Oppo research. And this is a huge get for them. I know they've had other catches in the past, but this might be one of their biggest, and it's certainly helpful for them as far as making a case to donors for why their project is important. So when you hear the NRCC talking about how this, you know, farmer situation could potentially be, you know, Bruce Braley's 47%, one, I think there's a case to be made for that. It remains to be seen. I don't think it's a great case, but, you know, there's a valid case there. But then number two, it just highlights the influence that organizations like America Rising can have on these really competitive races.
Yeah, I mean, and the Todd Akin was picked up by the counterpart of America Rising last cycle, American Bridge, mm-hmm. I think.
That was American Bridge, and 47% right. was Mother Jones. Is that right?
Right. Okay. I mean, it's really amazing. I mean, the thing is, campaigns in this age of, you know, constant news and breaking news, it's amazing how closed off candidates are and how sensitive campaigns are to everything a candidate says. And still these groups get into these fundraisers and meetings and, you know, the comments are said. It seems like it's a lot harder to run for Congress these days.
It doesn't sound like
and
fun.
That's one of the reasons. What? It doesn't sound like fun at all. I do, by the way, think sometimes about what it would be like if I ran for Congress, and I'd sink in the first 10 days. I don't even. You know.
Well, and you know, that's an interesting factor in any of these races. Is you know, one of the things that I think donors look for in candidates is discipline. You know, not saying mm-hmm. crazy stuff in public. I imagine. Chosen at random, just about any member of Congress has said something in his or her career that would render him or her completely unelectable. But the reason these folks are in Congress and other people aren't is because they have the discipline to say that stuff to their family members or to their close friends, and not to say it when there are reporters hanging around or, you know, super PAC employees with recorders.
It makes for kind of boring coverage, don't you think? I mean, it's kind of like, I mean, the pressure to be disciplined is so great that it's kind of, I at least for, as a reporter, it you know, it's harder to really get an idea of who the candidate is. Mm-hmm. And I imagine as a voter, it's even worse.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, it just, because
I think that's why
there's so much discipline about that.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's why political reporters loved Steve Stockman. Was because there's, you know, basically zero filter there. And on top of, you know, his own personal willingness to say wacky stuff, you have his Twitter feed that was, you know, like, that at times read like an internet commenter. So you have these candidates that are running non-campaigns that are completely unserious, but national political reporters will invest significant amounts of time, you know, myself included, in following these races just because it's interesting. I mean, part of the reason that we like politics and that it's fun is because of the stories and the humanity of candidates and the personalities. Like, you know, for the vast majority of political junkies or people who follow politics closely, I think that's one of the most compelling parts. And, you know, while absolutely from a campaign strategy perspective, you might want to get your candidate's, you know, persona as nicely tailored as possible, it is kind of a bummer for people who like politics for the entertainment value.
Yeah, I mean, the Stockman is a great example. Mm-hmm. There was this huge hunger for, I think, his candidacy to really pick up, but he was such a bad candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And Cornyn was such a strong candidate in that race that it just seemed unlikely. You know, I think there are two factors this cycle that everyone is waiting for. One is this really, I mean, the big theme of this cycle is Republican on Republican fighting, right? And, you know, these sort of very, very tense primary challenges. And the other one is the Todd Akin moment. And we could still see the Todd Akin moment. I don't know. I mean, that's much harder to predict, but like, there are definitely opportunities for a fascinating race like that. And so far, I'm still waiting. I don't know about you, Betsy, but like, even the most, the races that everyone says are, you know, the biggest and most contentious, like, Chris McDaniel versus Thad Cochran in Mississippi, or even, you know, I guess Louisiana, where it's Bob Manis is the Tea Party favorite conservative challenger against Bill Cassidy. It's kind of come up short, and I'm wondering if you think the discipline pressure is what's holding that back, or it's just yet to come. We're still months out from, you know, election night eve.
Yeah, I wish there was a gaffe index, you know? I would keep track of how much wacky stuff these candidates have said over the course of the last 10 years. You know, and it's hard to say if people are becoming more disciplined or if just the new ways that we report on and consume news have made it so that these, you know, small, dorky comments can blow up into, you know, Twitter conversations that last for days.
Yeah,
I think when you have a smaller news media or when you have a slower news media or when it's just print, it's a lot harder to get, you know, dorky stuff like this as a dominant part of the narrative. But now, thanks to blogs, and I think this is a good thing, now we can. So, I mean, as far as, you know, the whole sitting on the edge of your seat waiting for primary candidates to say something bizarre, I mean, I think that's certainly, you know, never completely out of the question. I think maybe part of the reason that we haven't had candidates pulling Akins is because Akin was such a spectacular flame out that, you know, every single Tea Party candidate knows that, you know, if they say something absurd like that they probably won't win. And then also, I think Akin's beliefs about rape and women's health are certainly not mainstream within the Republican Party. I don't think all these candidates are walking around thinking, oh man, I have to make sure I don't talk about how I don't think rape is real. Like, you know, I just think Akin's convictions there are not normal. So it doesn't make sense to expect people to say stuff like that. Now, that said, from a very craven, lowbrow perspective, I think if there's a race to watch where something like that might come out, it's the Georgia Senate primary. You've got Congressman Gingrey, who actually went on record saying that Akin was partly or mostly right. You've also got Congressman Paul Brown, who's very much known for his, I don't know, comfort level.
Rhetoric.
Yeah, inflammatory rhetoric. Yeah, you know, comfort level with talking about how evolution is a lie from hell and stuff. If we're just looking at folksy, colorful politicians, I think that's definitely a race to watch. I think also part of the reason that we haven't heard more of this wacky stuff from Manis in Louisiana is just that his campaign hasn't been that competitive. You know, they're way behind on fundraising. Yeah. They're not really taken seriously statewide. I think at this point, Cassidy is basically the presumptive nominee. So there's not a lot of...
It's funny you mentioned Georgia, because I actually wrote a story basically saying exactly what you said. Mm-hmm. It just popped out of my mind. Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about Georgia also is that, like... I mean, the thing about Braley that's really fascinating is that Braley's like... That one, Braley was one of these few Senate seats that Democrats could say, like, it may be a really bad cycle for us, but at least we're going to win in Iowa. I don't think this gaffe loses the seat, but it raises more attention and it gives, I think, Republicans an opening to make it.
I totally agree.
At least.
I totally agree. I think it raises attention. I think the vultures start circling. I think donors get a little bit shy. I think, you know, people at the NRSC lick their chops and think about what other wacky stuff this guy has said. And that's how I think sometimes comments like these can have a snowball effect. Even though, you know, making a rude crack about farmers is probably not enough to disqualify someone in the eyes of most Iowan voters for the Senate, it definitely can have an effect, especially this early on. You know, it's just like, who is this guy? Have you seen the 30 Rock? Do you watch 30 Rock?
Yeah.
Okay. You know the episode where... Jack Donaghy's talking to Liz Lemon and he's wearing a tux.
Oh yeah, so
and
so the whole
and
episode,
like, why are you
right,
wearing a tux? And he just looks at her and he has this amazing facial expression. He's like, "It's after six, Lemon. I'm not a farmer."
I would not be surprised if we see ads comparing Bruce Braley to Jack.
I
Donaghy
hope so.
And,
I would love that.
I think it would be really click-worthy, and it would, you know, get a lot of attention. I think we just, we're not helping the Braley campaign here.
I know.
But the flip side is, like you said, is Georgia. Georgia is a weird case this cycle,
mm-hmm.
too,
yep.
where Democrats feel they have a really strong opening to win a seat because of this primary,
mm-hmm.
Where they have these really... colorful candidates who are all like fighting each other.
Yeah.
And like the thing about Paul Brown is that one of his sort of signature features is that he has his congressional office is full of hunting trophies, which he's reportedly like killed himself.
Oh yeah. I did a big profile of him about a year ago and he, you know, walked me through his office and showed me all these animals and told me that he'd eaten all of them. And talked about how the lion was kind of chewy and not as tasty. And it's just, you know, he's a character. I don't think being a big game hunter is a liability in Georgia. But
no,
I think
probably not.
but I think that I don't know. I think maybe the most interesting thing about the Georgia race is that nobody's said anything disqualifying yet.
Right. And do you think that's partially because of the landscape and sort of the conservative or the Republican lean of the state? I mean, because there have been. You know, Brown has said a few things that I think in other states might be a little more damaging.
Mm-hmm.
They've all, you know, most of the candidates at one debate raised their hands when they said, you know, should we impeach President Obama? Brown was most enthusiastic about that. His hand shot up first. and then there was Phil Gingrey's lunchbox comments that schools, poor children should work for their school lunches. But none of those comments have really thrown them out. You're right.
Right.
But Brown is in the lead now. Why is that, Betsy?
You know, what I've heard about Georgia primaries is that typically the person who wins the first round of the primary loses the runoff. It could be that, you know, I think Brown is going to have a lot of support in the northern part of the state, where there are people who are more Ron Paul friendly. It's a little more rural. And I think what's my guess is that the most likely Georgia scenario would be it'd be feasible that Brown could win the primary, but definitely not with the requisite number of votes to prevent a runoff. And then I think Georgia Republicans will coalesce around the number two person. I haven't written about this race recently, so I'm not super up as far as the fundraising game and stuff, but my gut would say that Congressman Kingston or Karen Handel are probably best positioned mm-hmm. for that. You know, Kingston's from Southern
Handel, interesting.
Yeah, Handel and Congressman Price are very close friends. They both have really deep connections in Atlanta, where you have to do very well if you're going to win. She'll have good fundraising ties. She ran statewide for governor and almost beat Governor Deal, even though she was very outspent. She's been Secretary of State. Her name ID is good. Her spat with Planned Parenthood is definitely not going to be a liability in Georgia. I think she's probably more competitive than we're giving her credit for. And then also Kingston, you know, with his history on the Appropriations Committee, isn't going to have that much trouble raising funds. So those two seem like the most competitive to me. But again, I haven't written about this in the last few months, so it's possible that I'm misreading it.
Mm-hmm. We gotta move on to another topic.
I just want to talk about Paul Brown all day.
Yeah, I. who wouldn't?
Who wouldn't?
He's an interesting
who
guy.
Who are these people
and,
who don't want to talk
you know,
about Paul Brown all the time?
Right. I think Georgia is the campaign reporter's dream this cycle. Michelle Nunn versus Paul Brown would be awesome. The other big campaign news is Nate Silver's rollout of the redesigned, refurbished 538.com.
Mm-hmm.
So far, it's been a really interesting rollout because he projected going out, his first big projection was that Republicans have a 60% chance of winning the Senate. And most people, I think, read that or took that in as, you know, oh, Democrats are doomed. This is a big surprise push. And it was definitely something that Republicans were very happy to hear. I personally was actually, I thought that was a kind of interesting and reserved assessment, given sort of the general mood in Congress and in the political world that Democrats are very much on defense. And 60%, it's okay. It's not great. It definitely is something that can change mm-hmm. with a few comments. But it didn't ingratiate Silver with Democrats. Mm-hmm. And Silver's also been battling with Paul Krugman lately.
Mm-hmm.
Which I, you know, a colleague pointed out to me that this might actually give him, I mean, I don't think his assessments are tainted by, you know, ambition or sort of a popularity contest.
Right.
But I think it gives him a little more cred because, you know, in 2012, he was saying President Obama and Democrats would be okay. And in 2008, same thing. So I'm actually pretty surprised with how modest the rollout has been, and I wonder what role 538 is going to play this cycle.
Yeah, I think Democrats' response to Silver was a little silly. Anytime you have an entire party sort of going into a public paroxysm is not helpful, especially given that Silver's public about his liberalism, and that you know it seems like. It seems unserious to argue that he makes his predictions based on his partisan, you know, beliefs. So that was kind of unusual to me. I think if I'd been at the DNC, I would have responded differently. The fight with Paul Krugman is really entertaining. It's like it's hard, and you can't imagine anything geekier happening ever. The Nate Silver fighting with Paul Krugman. It's
no.
like
it's
like
so many layers.
It's like
geekery,
Mortal Kombat Dream Edition or something. I mean,
and there are two personalities that are really really strong,
mm-hmm.
really outspoken. They're both really really smart
yeah.
and really well educated.
Yeah,
and it is kind of a refreshing fight. It's not the usual Obamacare stuff.
Yeah.
Or claims of socialism or extreme conservatism. It's something new,
mm-hmm.
which is nice.
I give it feud of the week status.
I think feud of the week is a fair assessment. But it was interesting. You're right. The Democratic response to the to Silver's assessment was interesting. On the one hand, they sort of denounced, they released a memo saying, Silver isn't always right, sometimes he's wrong. And then they also start fundraising off and saying, Nate Silver just had a new projection and we're on defense.
Do you get the emails from D-Trip, Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee? They're so... Either everyone at D-Trip is just, sitting in, wetting their pants every single morning, or they're totally histrionic, because it's insane. I mean, every subject line is something like, terrible news, lose the Senate, doom. I mean...
Well, what would you do?
Maybe that works, I don't know, but it's just, I don't know,
I mean, there's an apocalyptic sort of, I don't know how fundraising works. I don't know who responds to what. But it is, if I'm Congressional Democrats campaign arm, no one really says that there's a strong chance that Democrats are going to regain control of the House.
Right.
But internally, I would be more interested in figuring out a way to change the shape of the House Republican caucus, to possibly get guys in who are more willing to work with Democrats, which would be difficult. Mm-hmm. But I think that is the better strategy now. And it's a hard strategy to even see if that's what they're doing, but it's hard to fundraise at all.
Exactly. And it's tricky because there's a conflict between what you have to say publicly, like what your messaging has to be, and then, what your actual strategy based on your perception of reality is. D-Trip can't say, hey guys, we're not going to win the House, sorry, better luck next time. They can't say that. If they said that, it would be the banner of Drudge for 2 weeks, and their donations would dry up. So they have to say, we have a shot, we only need to get so many seats. They have to say that. But I don't think any serious political observers think that's true. I don't think anyone thinks that's true. If there is someone who thinks that's true, I would be interested in reading that. Just nobody thinks that. Mm-hmm. And that's a weird and unpleasant challenge for D-Trip right now. I think if there is panic, it definitely should be on the senatorial side, and we're seeing a little bit of that. But I don't know.
I may be the last one who very much thinks this is a little bit more up in the air, and that Republicans have the advantage in the moment, but nothing is a sure thing in the Senate. It's just so far out.
You think the House is up in the air?
No, I don't think the House is up in the air. I don't think the Senate, I wouldn't say it's up in the air, but I wouldn't say that Democrats are out of it yet. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure the blogging heads commenters will just totally skewer me for this.
High
I just don't, it's hard to, yeah, high commenters. It's just hard for me to even imagine that. And frankly, this is one of the topics we wanted to cover today. It's weird. The factor of how these outside groups like the Madison Project and the Senate Conservatives Fund plays in these races, I think, is a factor too.
Mm-hmm.
Those groups and their involvement in boosting these candidates that stop establishment candidates from very cleanly getting the nomination this time, and in some cases are totally taking out the incumbent Republican, I think plays a serious role that makes control of the Senate a little bit more unpredictable.
If SCF's entire spate of candidate wins, that oddly enough, Democrats could have a better shot at keeping the Senate.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the candidate.
Yeah,
SCF
is a right. I think it's an interesting question. Going back to Aiken, we were talking about earlier, one of the really interesting things about that race is, arguably his one comment had an enormously outsized impact on the 2012 election results, right? We all agree on that.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible Republicans would have taken the Senate back. It's very conceivable that Republicans would have taken the Senate back if Aiken hadn't said that and he hadn't been the nominee. Well, looking at that from an outside group's perspective, Aiken wasn't exactly the Tea Party favorite. Sarah Palin endorsed Sarah Silverman. And if the Palin candidate had won, it's possible things would be very different. So I think in in sort of coastal political journalism circles, it's easy to assume that some of these outside groups are sort of boogeymen or spoilers. But I think the reality is a lot more complex than that. Looking at some specific SCF races. Well, first, you know, one thing that SCF did that seems very sensible is they didn't endorse Stockman. You know, Hoskins had nice things to say about Stockman when he announced he was running, but they did not play in that race at all.
Matt Hoskins, the executive director of the group.
Yeah. Right. Matt Hoskins, executive director of the Senate Conservatives Fund. You know, obviously you've got Bevin in Kentucky, who, while he's running an interesting campaign, don't seem to be any serious indicators that he has a serious shot at winning the nomination there. So, you know, the only seat where it looks like an SCF candidate could actually take out an incumbent is Mississippi, as we talked about a little bit earlier, with Chris McDaniel going up against Senator Cochran. And I don't think McDaniel is a huge liability. You know, it's possible he'll say something really dumb, but I don't think so. He seems like a competent candidate. You know, he's got national support. I don't see SCF doing anything that seriously changes the outcome of which party controls the Senate this cycle.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about Mississippi, and we're very interested in that race, is that there hasn't been too much public polling out there on it. The funny thing also is that there's a Democrat running too, Travis Childers, who announced, I think last month, that he's running, and Democrats are hoping that he can play some kind of spoiler, at least troll them. But I think McDaniel is probably the candidate who has the best chance of winning a seat with these outside groups. And I don't, you know, it's interesting because Cochran has the support of a lot of, you know, big name Mississippi Republicans in the state. I don't really know what's going to happen there.
In my opinion, the most
effective outside group this cycle has actually been Americans for Prosperity, which has stayed out of the primaries and has instead hammered Democrats in places like Michigan and North Carolina especially, and Louisiana. And it's really, really put the Democrats on defense there. It's like right now, a lot of the time, it's more like the Democrats are running against AFP and not really whoever the primary challenger is.
One dynamic I think is really interesting, and I'm curious about your perspective of this since you understand progressive world a lot better than I do. One outside group that I feel like we don't talk about very much, but that's really interesting to me, is Emily's List. Given that they have a really long, successful track record of getting candidates elected. Two things that are interesting. One, I tried to get a comment from them on this earlier this week and they didn't call me back. But one thing that's interesting is their non-involvement in the Louisiana race. You know, Senator Landrieu, I think in 2002 or something, voted for the partial birth abortion ban. But besides that, she has a very pro-choice voting record. I don't think anyone would seriously argue that she's not a pro-choice female Democrat. And, you know, the outcome of that race could affect who controls the Senate. So it's interesting to me that Emily's List has chosen not to get involved there. While they have chosen to invest a lot of money in candidates like Wendy Davis, where, you know, the odds of Davis winning the gubernatorial election are very, very bad.
Less than perfect.
Less than perfect. The odds of Mary Landrieu getting reelected are much higher than the odds of Davis becoming governor. But Emily's List is dumping tons of money into Davis's campaign and not giving money to Landrieu. That's unusual to me.
I think these outside groups need a flashy candidate. They need a Matt Bevin or Wendy Davis.
The other thing that's interesting to me about Emily's List is they've had a bit of a rough track record over the last few months. They spent a lot of money on the Colorado state senator who lost the special election over Second Amendment stuff.
Right.
They spent a lot of money on Alex Sink, who lost in, I think, Florida 13. They also endorsed Christine Quinn early on and spent a lot of political capital on her campaign. All those candidates lost. And I think Emily's List is I think they're a very effective organization. I think as far as outside groups go, they've maybe had the most significant impact on what the Senate looks like and the House. I would be interested to read more reporting on some of the internal stuff going on there. I'd be interested in knowing more about their decision-making process, and if there's any level of concern about, you know, their high-profile losses over the last few months.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know. I think that's a great question. Why they haven't gotten involved in Louisiana? I wonder if the Emily's List name might be counterproductive.
The name might be, but the money wouldn't, right? Like, if they're giving tons of money.
The money wouldn't.
I mean, I totally agree on the name, for sure. But you'd also think it'd be counterproductive in Texas if it's a problem in Louisiana.
Yeah, and that's a good point. I honestly think that's a good question. Yeah. I'm going to go look into that, I think, after this blogging hits.
Yeah, totally.
My understanding about Emily's List, though, is that, unlike these other groups, which are very interested in putting their political leanings in the Senate or in Congress or politicians who match them politically.
Yeah.
Emily's List is more interested in getting fairly liberal women in Congress. Mm-hmm. And those are the two big factors in there. So
pro-choice
it's not
women.
Always...
Yeah.
Yeah, pro-choice women. So it's not always the most liberal candidate or it's not always... I mean, you can't be the most woman, but
yeah,
I think it's a more delicate balance.
Yeah.
There.
And they're right. I agree. And their project is really interesting because,
it's only ideological
on the abortion issue. Besides that, I mean, there are plenty of Emily's List endorsed candidates who aren't especially progressive.
Right. And in Hawaii, they backed, if I'm not mistaken, Colleen Hanabusa, who is the underdog in the Democratic primary against Senator Brian Schatz.
Mm-hmm.
And Schatz is, I think, a little more liberal than Hanabusa, although you'd have to look closely.
Mm-hmm.
But Emily's List is very much interested in Hanabusa, not Schatz.
Right. Or you look at the New York mayoral race, where
Christine
Quinn was certainly not a darling of progressives by any stretch of the imagination. But, you know, was a woman, was pro-choice, and that's the litmus test. And you have to respect organizations that have really specific litmus tests, and they've certainly been successful in getting those candidates elected in the past. But I think from the larger context of how progressives feel about Emily's List as an organization that makes American government more progressive, I imagine there's some tension there.
Mm-hmm. You know, The real victory, I think, with these outside groups is not necessarily a numbers game. It's who they bring in, especially in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Elizabeth Warren is a big victory for the progressive, I always get the PCCC, which is a very liberal outside group, and Emily's List.
Yeah,
and
for sure.
Ted Cruz is a big victory for SCF and those organizations.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, while the conservative-backed... candidates in the Senate, most of them probably won't get the nomination. Like, one or two victories in the Senate is a really, really good thing
for
these outside groups, because they get two more guys in there to join Ted Cruz and two more people to, you know, threaten filibusters and push the entire chamber to the right.
Didn't Senator DeMint say he'd rather have only 25 Republicans in the Senate if they were all Rubio than have 55 mainstream establishment Republicans.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The win record really does matter, but I think even more important is who is coming in. And it's not a numbers game. It's if they have any victory and how influential these people are.
Right.
I mean, One of the things we've seen in the last few days is Elizabeth Warren has been a little bit more active for Democrats on the campaign trail. She's been coming to the rescue a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
She came out very aggressively in fundraising emails when Scott Brown announced that he was forming an exploratory committee.
Yeah.
And most recently, she endorsed Bruce Braley, coincidentally, a day after that video surfaced.
Yeah, that's helpful, though.
Yeah, it is helpful, I think, in Iowa.
At least in terms of fundraising, right? At least nationally.
Yeah, at least in terms of fundraising. I think at the end of the day, you know, if Emily's List can bring in another one or two Elizabeth Warren type figures, you know, their win-loss record, especially in this year, won't really hurt them with donors. I think I expect, you know, the super wealthy to be like, well, we were going to, it was going to be a rough year anyway, but we brought in this person who's a really big champion of ours, or someone like Kirsten Gillibrand, who's very, very popular on the left and in sort of that sector of pro-choice advocacy
groups. I feel like she's less popular among the more progressive left. Is that fair to say? That she hasn't sort of been this populist voice the way Elizabeth Warren has?
Right. I mean, less so than Elizabeth Warren. I think Elizabeth Warren's Elizabeth Warren is, it's a hard comparison. Yeah, the thing about Gillibrand is that she was more conservative when she was a congresswoman, and she sort of moved her positions and has championed the women's issues a bit more and been, I mean, she's also, some of her critics hit her on Wall Street and her position on the bailout. And Dodd-Frank, I think. I'm probably confusing these two. But she's still really popular. It's probably an exaggeration, so I take that back, that she's wildly popular on the left, but she's still definitely one of these Democrats that a lot on the left really like, and a lot of the pro-choice community really likes. And when you need a champion on things like sexual assault in the military, that's Kirsten Gillibrand.
It's interesting how the abortion issue is very much a single, how it affects single issue voters on both sides of the ideological spectrum.
It's a polarizing topic.
Right. And it's also, you have a lot of people who are single issue voters on that issue. You know, during the Bush years, the one thing, you know, the one requisite was that you were pro-life. And if you were pro-life, you could support the Iraq War, you could support Medicare Part D, you know, all these policy changes that weren't seen as conservative. And you'd still have the backing of the base or of a significant sector of the base because of your stance on the abortion issue. And I think it's sort of a parallel among progressives, where, especially with Emily's List, where you've got candidates who aren't especially progressive, you know, who might not be as ideological on issues like economic progressivism. But if they're pro-choice and they have the pro-choice bona fides, then they'll have backing of this powerful organization. And it's just interesting that, like, and it makes sense because it is such a polarizing issue. Regardless of which side you're on, it's probably very important to you. But I think these social issues can sometimes hinder the ability of parties to advance their economic goals. Because you have candidates who have covering because of how they feel about social issues, and they can be, you know, fiscally centrist or less fiscally ideological.
Right. And I guess you're sort of suggesting that that's where Gillibrand is, that her stance on women's rights and her advocacy about sexual assault has sort of given her a little more cover as she's shifted farther to the left?
And, you know, I honestly, I'm not a Gillibrand expert. I haven't followed her career in the Senate as closely as some other senators. But my guess would be that her socially progressive positions give her cover or give her support that or political capital that she could expend on policies in other sectors that aren't as progressive. And Elizabeth Warren's because she's ideologically progressive across the board.
Right.
And, you know, Ted Cruz is interesting
and her because issue he's is, ideologically conservative. Her issue is kind of the opposite of Gillibrand's, right? I mean, her issue is, you know, Wall Street, and that's something and Gillibrand's issues are elsewhere.
Well, you can't really be a senator from New York and make Wall Street your issue, right?
Right. And I didn't want to point that out, but yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's hard to do it. It's a big money base for Democrats, and that's the big thing. But I think your Emily's List point is a really good one, and I think it's important to watch. And I think having a topic like abortion rights and contraceptive care can be very, very galvanizing for the base. Totally. But it also can it really heats people up, and you know. Luckily, you know, they say in the last few cycles that we've seen a decline of the moderate or the true independent, and I think these outside groups are trying to take advantage of that.
Yeah, well, and I think that kind of goes back to Bush's re-election strategy in 2004, when the thought process was, if we just get the base to turn out, you know, get all the Republicans, all the evangelicals, all the pro-life voters to the polls, that we don't have to win over independents. And obviously it was an effective strategy. As President Kerry can tell you, ha ha ha.
or President Obama.
Exactly,
in 2008.
Right.
Very much his whole unity thing, mm-hmm. and his let's bring everyone over, and I'm a liberal Democrat, but I'm not ideological at the same time,
mm-hmm.
which is inspiring.
Right.
We got to finish up with our last topic really quickly here. So I asked you to do this when we ran into each other at CPAC, and we're a little bit past sort of the CPAC hangover where reporters are all talking about what they saw and all this
mm-hmm.
stuff. But I was wondering if you had sort of like a few weeks later thought on CPAC. It was my first CPAC.
That's so special.
And yeah,
I wish they made picture frames that said like my first CPAC on them.
I was hoping I would get like a special reporter lanyard or something. My one big surprise about this is that how it's very much a niche event
mm-hmm.
for the party, and in that you know there are a lot of Rand Paul supporters
mm-hmm.
there. There are a lot of Ted Cruz supporters there. There are not a huge amount of super socially conservative voters there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
I think it's definitely a lot of post-Bush Republicans.
Right. And I didn't, if you sort of weight that, I didn't get a sense that there is a big favorite right now among the GOP.
Mm-hmm.
If you factor in the fact that there were a lot of Rand Paul supporters there.
Right.
And, you know, Ted Cruz is very popular, too.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think the big takeaway was a few weeks later? We've gone, you know, the news cycle's moved on to Nate Silver and Paul Krugman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are always two things about CPAC that I find really interesting. One is how well anyone whose last name is Paul does. In the last 5 years, Mitt Romney is the only person to win a CPAC straw poll, and he only won it once, whose last name wasn't Paul. You have Rand Paul, mm-hmm. Rand Paul, Mitt Romney, Ron Paul, Ron Paul. It's just a great event for Senator Paul and his supporters. They do very, very well. And that's kind of a universal, you know, that's just how CPAC works, which is interesting. Especially given that Senator Cruz has kind of postured himself as the champion of the base. It's interesting that at an event that is such a, you know, red meat conservative base weekend, that Paul kind of blew Cruz out of the water. I think that's significant.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing that, and this is my third CPAC, the second thing that has always struck me about it is how much people love Sarah Palin.
That was really this year, right.
She spoke on the last day last year. And I mean, I, you know, tell reporters you have to be in the room with Palin speaking because people love her. And I think in sort of the Acela corridor reporting environment, and I try not to be smug about this because I'm definitely as much a creature of D.C. as anyone else, but in this environment, it's easy to see Palin as a punchline or as an unserious person or as not that big of a deal. But then you go to CPAC and just being there when people are jumping out of their seats as she makes these jokes that we might find corny or predictable. It really, there's a palpable sense in which you see that the conservative base loves Sarah Palin, takes her very seriously, admires her. Yeah.
So, I mean, and the thing about Palin is that she's been endorsing left and right the past few days.
Mm-hmm.
It's just been all over the place. I think one of her most recent endorsements, I think, is T.W. Shannon out in Oklahoma.
She endorsed T.W. Shannon. She also endorsed Joni Ernst, who had the pig castration ad. Yeah,
pig castration. Which, by the way, I thought was really, really smart. A lot of people have been saying that it was kind of goofy, but it was free airtime.
Yeah, totally.
The timing was great because it came out the same day of this Braley thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, it gets you coverage when you don't.
Totally.
There's not a lot of name recognition.
Yeah, I don't think Joni Ernst is going to win Columbia Heights, but but I don't see the ad as being a problem for her at all.
Yeah. But, yeah, so Palin's been endorsing left and right. How do you, I mean, given that we see that there's, I mean, by this very imperfect sort of measure that she's popular, how do you think these endorsements are going to get any weight? They don't seem to be getting a lot of coverage.
Yeah, I think they will. I think Palin endorsements definitely matter, especially to grassroots activists. You know, Cruz says he wouldn't have won the primary if Palin hadn't endorsed. That's a game changing endorsement. It's going to be interesting to see how effective that endorsement is in Iowa. I imagine it'll get a lot of mileage in Oklahoma. Her endorsement of T.W. Shannon is very important. Yeah, I think it matters. And I think it also goes back to what we were talking about earlier about candidates being really, having, you know, huge filters and being super hyper-disciplined. You know, Sarah Palin is the opposite of that. And I think part of the reason that people like her so much is just that she comes across as very human. And you just read through her Facebook page and it's like chain emails and stuff, you know, like this, you know, this woman could be your aunt. And there's very much, you know, an enormous personality, you know, a very effective persona. And I think for people who are frustrated with a lot of sort of the sterilization of the Beltway, that that Palin brings something to the political conversation that other commentators and activists and leaders don't.
See, I'm a little bit more skeptical of Palin's, the effect of Palin, of a Palin endorsement this cycle. Partially because, I mean, the one endorsement that I can see that sort of fizzled out was Katrina Pearson in Texas, who she was endorsed by Palin and she ran against Pete Sessions, and she was very much a favorite of these two workers, and she didn't win. I feel like these outside groups are more influential this cycle than a Sarah Palin endorsement was in 2012, but I could, you know what, I'm wrong on all kinds of stuff. I thought Wichita would win. I thought Alex Sink would win.
Oh, buddy.
So but I have the University of Michigan, my alma mater, going, and they're still going strong.
Crisis of confidence. So. Well, I mean, I think very quickly on Pearson, I don't think that race was winnable for her. The district is right outside Dallas. It's not a Tea Party hotbed. I think also Palin's endorsement came pretty late in the game. So I don't know that we can see that as something to undermine the effectiveness of a Palin endorsement. And obviously just because Palin endorses someone doesn't mean they'll win. But I think especially when you look at primaries, her endorsement's very important. And also when you look at primaries that are open seats, rather than primaries against incumbents, and particularly in Oklahoma. It's going to be interesting to see how T.W. Shannon does and how that race shapes up.
Yeah, I mean, I was really looking forward to that race. Tom Coburn's really fascinating. I was hoping that Jim Bridenstine would run and we would have a very, very contentious race between Lankford, who is a little bit more associated with the establishment and the religious right, and Jim Bridenstine, who's the darling of the conservative right outside groups. Right. He's the man.
Right. Sort of like a second Jesse Wash.
Yeah, and so now we have T.W. Shannon, who, I mean, could be good.
Yeah.
So anyway, we went way over. sorry about that. But this has been great, Betsy. I'm really glad we did this.
For sure.
And this has been good.
Good talk.
Good talk, man. I will talk to you later.
Sounds good.
Bye. All right, thanks.